are you?
Good. Hi, Susan.
Good morning. It is May the 28th, Thursday. This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. And we are here to work on a half dozen or so bills today. Why don't you give us the scoop?
Okay, we're going to start off with Senate Bill 475, and then we have hopefully some members coming down to testify on 473. And then the plan is to move on to Senate Bill 519 and then Senate Bill 81. Do we want to open?
And these are public hearings only, is that correct? So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 475.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 475 requires the students and youth care centers within a detention facility to receive educational services through the Juvenile Detention Education Program. The bill will allow the provider of the educational services within the detention facility to claim the students in the youth care centers as part of the average daily membership, which is used to calculate the distribution of state school funds. The bill does not change the total state school fund formula revenue, but it will have an estimated shift in the state school funds, which is an estimated impact of $161,782 general fund. So there is no additional appropriations needed for this bill, but it will cause a shift in the state school fund.
And do we have people that want to testify on 475?
Dan Carr.
Dan Carr. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Co-chairs Monroe and Comp and members of the committee, my name is Dan Carr, and I am the detention manager for the Douglas County Juvenile Department here in Oregon, and it is my honor to testify in front of you today on a subject that doesn't affect a vast portion of the juvenile justice system, but for my county, a county who currently operates a youth care center, this is a welcomed piece of legislation. Currently, there are two populations of youth served in local juvenile justice detention facilities, youth placed in detention and youth placed in treatment programs referred to in statute as youth care centers. Youth in detention have an average length of stay between 7 and 16 days. Education is provided through a contracted provider with the Oregon Department of Education, and youth are both pre-adjudicated and post-adjudication while they're staying with us. Youth in youth care centers have average length of stay between 90 and 120 days. Education is the responsibility of the local school district in which juvenile detention facilities are located. Youth are ordered into the program post-adjudication. And again, are there generally for a much longer stay than your average detention youth. Currently, youth who are participating in youth care center programs which are operated within detention facilities receive 190 days of education. Youth who are detained within the same detention facility for a variety of reasons enrolled in the Juvenile Detention Education Program, or JDEP, and offered 220 days for detention youth. So the purpose of this legislation is to bring equality to both groups of students. So we would like to bring youth care center youth and offer them the same 220 days of education as we would for youth that are just standard in detention and generally there for a shorter period of time. And this piece of legislation would do that for us.
Okay. Are there questions for the witness, Mr. Carr? We also have Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Does this affect NORCOR and Molly Rogers in the Gorge area that serves a number of counties?
I believe so, yes.
And we have a letter on OLIS from the Director of Student Services in Roseburg Public Schools, Mr. Matt Brossom. In strong support of this bill.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. We are not going to be voting on this today because we haven't been given the authority to do that yet.
Thank you for your time.
I'm sure it'll be next week. Thank you. At that time, we will close then the public hearing on 475 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 473.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 473 will require the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, also known as the HEC, to work with community colleges to determine and report on methods for community colleges to administer a collection of sexual orientation identification data and allow enrolled students to use preferred first names on certain college documents. The HEC will also establish by rule a common format and time frame for the collection and reporting of the demographic data, evaluating compliance and reporting annually on the progress. This work is estimated to require a limited duration program analyst 3 position at a 0.25 FTE and an estimated cost of $53,707 in general fund in the 2015-17 biennium.
And this bill is brought to us by Senator Gelser. Welcome to our committee. Come on up.
Can Representative Nose come too?
Oh, sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, and members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Corvallis, Philomath, Albany, Tangent, Millersburg, and a lot of other areas in the region. I'm pleased to be here today to talk to you a little bit about Senate Bill 473. Representative Huffman, you may recognize this bill. We had it last year in our committee, so it may look very familiar, but it has had some modifications. The bill is very simple. It allows students, when they are filling out demographic forms, information that collects demographic information at a higher education institution, to voluntarily indicate their sexual orientation. The reason that this is important is to be able to collect that same demographic information for analysis, just as we do for gender, income, race, any other subgroup, so that we can see how a population of students is doing and making sure that we are supporting students to get them all the way through their higher education career. This bill has changed modestly from last session in that it includes community colleges in addition to the universities, and it also addresses the issue of a preferred name. There are a number of reasons why an individual may wish to use a different name than their legal name in their daily activities. That could be related to transition, related to gender identity. It also could be related to international students that are enrolled on a campus and wish to use a different familiar name. This bill would allow students to do that, to use their preferred name in any place where federal law doesn't otherwise make that difficult or disallowed. I did work with a registrar at Oregon State University to make sure that this is clear and ready to go, and we got a green light before it moved out of the Senate Education Committee, and I'm happy to answer any questions, and Representative Nose has some further information as well.
Yeah, why don't we hear from Representative Nose first, and then we'll take questions of the panel. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gelser,
are you enjoying your first session in the legislature?
Actually. Yeah, it's a lot harder job than I thought, though.
It is a lot harder, but you learn a lot.
Yeah, for sure. Anyhow, Senator Gelser gave, like, pretty much all my testimony. So I'll just say that, no, it's all right. You did a very good job without notes. I'll just say that, you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people, especially young people, who face things like homelessness, joblessness, hunger, and other societal problems at disproportionate rates relative to other folks in the population. And
Representative Nose, you have to put your name on the record.
I forgot to do that. Rob Nose, State Representative, House District 42, Southeast and Northeast Portland. And so because these folks sometimes experience societal problems at disproportionate rates relative to heterosexual or cisgender peers, and we don't track information very well about how they're progressing through their college career, we think this bill will help. And some of you might know that this is a bill that came to you through the Oregon Student Association and their advocacy, and I got my start politically with them in the 1990s during the 93 and 95 session, and I'm happy to help them try to get this bill across the finish line this session. I know it has a small fiscal, so hopefully you'll find $53,000 and help make this happen.
And Mr. Chair, I would like to make a minor correction. Nikki Fisher, who's my staff, preps me, and I do have notes. She wants me to remember to smile, so she gives me notes about things that make me smile, and today's note says hot air balloons and goats.
Goats?
Yeah, that's an inside. We all know about goats.
And I have a little plaque that I showed to a witness in my office this morning that says, trouble with this country is the people that really know how to run things are busy teaching school.
Good,
Senator
good
Huffman, or Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may have said this, but as we've dealt with this in the past, it's been voluntary.
Yes.
And this will remain voluntary, right?
Yes, it will.
Chair Monroe, Representative Huffman, it remains voluntary for the students, but the institutions must provide a spot on the form for them to voluntarily do that.
Good clarification. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's very important. Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, I was a little confused. Well, I got confused because I read this more of the summary here online. But, Senator, you shared that this is definitely all in place, that you worked with the registrar at Oregon State. Is the community college piece going to be smoothly? I mean, I'm concerned about transfer of, you know, what their transcripts are going to, is if there won't be some confusion if I didn't know if you worked with the community colleges at all.
So Co-Chair Monroe and Co-Chair Monroe, the fiscal actually comes from the community college system to address the costs that are related to that. But the issues with the transcripts and the preferred names, those issues in terms of what's required from the federal government with names as they relate to transcripts and credit transfer and financial aid, all of those, it doesn't really matter what institution, what kind of institution that you're in. And so that's what we were trying to get at with those conversations.
Thank you for your clarification.
Names can be pretty important and sometimes confusing. I happen to use my middle name. So when somebody calls up our house and asks for Wayne Monroe, my wife knows they really don't know who I am.
Right.
And so they don't get through.
Right.
Other questions for the witnesses?
Unless it's a pollster, then I always want to know what they're up for.
Yeah, me too.
Thanks. And Rob, hanging out with Sarah is a good idea.
Yeah, okay. I think so too.
Otherwise, yeah. Your last comment about pollsters was TMI.
Okay.
Okay, let's have Mr. Dentz, Mr. Hall, and Ms. Gibbons. And welcome to you all. Dentz, why don't you go ahead?
Please. Good morning. Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Dentz, President of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate, and coincidentally, Professor of Political Science at Eastern Oregon University. We represent the faculty of Oregon's public universities. IFS supports the principles of inclusiveness and access for all in higher education in Oregon. Senate Bill 473 requiring all higher ed institutions to allow students, faculty, and staff to change their first names and self-identify sexual orientations on forms used to collect demographic data sends a clear and convincing message to the LGBT community that the state of Oregon continues to stand for the core values of inclusiveness in higher education. In order to promote the successful implementation of the letter and spirit of Senate Bill 473, IFS would offer two cost-neutral suggestions rooted in best practices for the committee to contemplate. First, universities nationwide, for example, Tufts, Duke, and the University of Oregon, provide students the opportunity to fill in their gender on housing and or admissions applications as opposed to a checking-the-box reporting strategy. This fill-in format evades the pigeonholing of preoperative transsexual students, faculty, and staff. Secondly, IFS considers the University of Wisconsin to be a leader in preferred first name practice, as students, faculty, and staff can unilaterally indicate a preferred first name to appear alongside or instead of a legal name. And I provided a link to their policy in my testimony. IFS urges the committee to consider this alongside option as currently utilized by the University of Wisconsin, which upon implementation should have minimal long-term fiscal implications on Oregon's public universities and community colleges. Alongside with affordability, access is one of the linchpins of the state's ambitious 40-40-20 goals and is consistent with Title IX and Oregon's anti-discrimination laws. Taking on a new name and being allowed the freedom to self-report one's sexual identity is often the first step in an individual's transition towards living in accordance with their gender identity. Senate Bill 473 is an important step in ensuring an inclusive higher education community in Oregon. Thank you for your time. I'd be glad to take any questions you may have.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead and finish the panel, and then we'll fire questions at you. Why don't you go ahead?
Great. Good morning. My name is C.M. Hall, and I wanted to first thank the leaders who have shepherded this bill to get this in front of you, Senator Gelser and Representative Nose. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. As mentioned, my name is C.M. Hall and I work at Western Oregon University. I coordinate the Western Region Interpreter Education Center, and I also teach a number of courses, including lesbian, gay, bi, trans, and queer studies. I'm also a member of the board of Basic Rights Oregon, which is our state's leading advocacy organization for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities, and we represent tens of thousands of Oregonians from every corner of this state. And we're here to strongly urge passage of Senate Bill 473. As Senator Gelser eloquently stated earlier, Senate Bill 473 would require public universities and colleges to add sexual orientation and gender identity to the list of routine demographic data already collected on existing forms. And these form updates would be complete at the time of reprinting, so really the cost incurred is minimal. And the other, and as any other demographic information is optional for anyone to fill out, so would this be. But this has real impact for the students who are attending our public universities and institutions to allow them to use a first name other than their legal first name on campus records such as class lists, school directories, student ID cards, and diplomas. It is a modest but important proposal to collect important information to address disparities and protect the safety and privacy of students. And as I mentioned, it is modest, but this change has an intangible effect of honoring the dignity of students I work with, like James, a young trans man whose gender identity Western Oregon University is working to respect in terms of housing, student records, and honoring his name as he goes by. According to Too Afraid to Learn, a 2008 survey of more than 3,500 Oregon college students, a hostile campus climate was a significant impact on LGBT students. The findings included the fact that 10% of LGBT students took more than 5 years to graduate, and that was largely due to anti-LGBT sentiment. More than half of these students concealed their sexual orientation or gender identity on campus for fear of personal safety, discrimination, or rejection. And more than 60% of all students reported witnessing instances of homophobia and transphobia ranging from language to violence. It is estimated that the fiscal impact will be approximately $53,000. And to work and to also incorporate community colleges to determine how to report what methods are best for them to implement this. This is a small investment when you consider the positive impact this has in terms of data collection for how we accurately assess who our LGBTQ community in our Oregon higher institutions are. Clear, consistent data collection would allow Oregon colleges and universities to accurately assess and appropriately address the experiences of LGBT students and faculty and staff as well. Senate Bill 473 would allow students, faculty, and staff to identify their sexual orientation and gender identity on forms collecting demographic information without mandating collection. We strongly urge passage of Senate Bill 473 in its entirety, and we thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gibbons.
Chairman Rowe and members of the committee, my name is Jay Gibbons, and I am the LGBTQ support staff on college campuses throughout the state of Oregon with the Oregon Student Association. I support student governments on 10 campuses ranging from LeGrand to Monmouth all the way down to Ashland. My job is to help retain LGBTQ students, and I'm here today to urge your support of Senate Bill 473. The students that I work with encounter many challenges on a daily basis being LGBTQ in college, but one of the greatest is that their community is invisible. One of the students I work closely with recently lost all of the support of her family because she came out as LGBTQ. She lost her only support network and turned to the campus counseling center for help and resources. However, no one at that counseling center was LGBTQ or specially trained to support students who are having trouble coming out. Because of this, the student has come close to dropping out several times this year because of the lack of resources and support for her on her campus. Another student I've worked with for several years is trying to establish a gender and sexuality resource center on his campus. His campus is often profiled as one that has few to none no LGBTQ students. When he started talking to leaders on his campus about establishing this resource center, many people questioned if it was even a need on the campus. He asked me to help support his work by looking for data on how many LGBTQ students were on his campus, but there was none. The center is a critical resource on campus because isolated LGBTQ students face depression, lower rates of completion, thoughts of suicide, and significant health disparities. LGBTQ students across the state want to stand up and be counted. The invisibility of our community is a constant reminder of the isolation that many LGBTQ students struggle with. This isolation from friends and family has caused Oregon students to desperately need the support and resources on their campuses to help retain them, but also to help them thrive. And we can only do this when we truly know just how big this community is and what its needs are. That is why we need to pass this bill that allows for opt-in data collection. I'm here today to ask for your help in assisting LGBTQ students in higher education and supporting Senate Bill 473. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions for the witnesses? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just for clarification, Dance, were you suggesting an amendment of sorts? You were talking about a neutral inclusion of something, or did I misunderstand?
Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Huffman, I believe a legislative note may be sufficient in terms of providing HEC with instruction as they develop the policy for implementation.
And the sponsors behind you, I guess, are acknowledging that they understand that and
sure.
May work with you or whatever. Okay, thanks.
Good. Additional questions for the witnesses? Thank you very much for coming and sharing with us. Madam Co-Chair?
Yes, I was wondering if Senator Gelser could come back up. I have a different question.
Senator Gelser will come back up.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Smiling.
Pickles and cream or something.
Goats.
Goats.
Okay, goats. Well, I've milked a few, and they're okay.
That sounds really fun.
It is fun. But as some younger students have just come into our room, immediately I recalled several situations at the high school level where there wasn't just bullying of this community of students. There was actually students, you know, got taken out back in PE class and beat up. I mean, it was quite vicious, but that was in the 1990s. But have you considered looking at different age levels that we could protect our students better than what we are now? Yeah, I guess that's the question, where you're such an advocate, and so I'm going to impose that question on you.
Co-Chair Comp, Co-Chair Monroe, and again, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, State Senator from Senate District 8. I think that's a very important thing, and although we have made great strides in equality, LGBTQ students at every age still face significant challenges and discrimination, harassment, and bullying. We have worked in recent years, and as you may recall, several of you on the panel have been part of the work that we've done around bullying issues. Basic Rights Oregon has been a tremendous partner in working on that. Disparate discipline policies, all of these things impact underserved and marginalized students. There is a lot that we can expect as well of leadership at the school level. A lot of these issues around bullying and harassment are very, very difficult to legislate. We can agree that they're wrong. The First Amendment sometimes makes things very challenging. But I was recently incredibly impressed and proud of the principal of my children's high school. You may have heard of an application that's available on your iPhone. It's called Burn Book. And on Burn Book, it's organized by different high school communities. People can sign up, their IP addresses are masked, and they say terrible things about other students by first and last name. They publish photos. It's just horrible. It's a horrible thing. Our principal became aware of this, and it had escalated to a point where a lot of harassment based on gender, mm-hmm. based on sexual orientation, a lot of rumors, and then there were inappropriate photos that were being posted as well. There wasn't anything legally that we could do about that, but the principal of this high school got on the intercom and let his student body know that that was not acceptable behavior for that high school community, and that it would not be tolerated in that high school community, and regardless of criminal sanctions that might be available, that if he were to find anyone was engaged in that type of cyber harassment and bullying, they would be removed from their school activities, they would be removed from their athletic teams, and if they were a senior, they would not be graduating, they would not be walking with their graduating class. Burn Book ended after that day for that high school, except for a number of comments about how angry they were at their principal. But that type of leadership and demonstrating that it's not kids will be kids will pick on each other, but very, very clear direction, this is not acceptable to treat people this way, is something that I think we can expect of our educational leaders. And it works when people take those bold steps. And that guy is Matt Boring. He's a pretty good guy.
Yeah, well, thank you, because I couldn't agree with you more, but seeing those impacts firsthand made me think about it, so thank you.
Yes. Thank you for the question.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to have to move along because we have a lot of people here to talk to us about the last bill on our list. So before we do that, I'll close the public hearing on 473 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 519.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 519 directs community college districts to use the same system for reporting finances. The bill also directs the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to select and provide guidelines for the system. The bill has a fiscal impact of one position, 0.25 FTE, and an estimated general fund impact is $69,862.
And we have Jared signed up to testify. Come on up.
Good morning. Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, members of the committee, Jared Mason Gear, representing the Oregon Education Association and 42,000 educators across the state. The legislature has taken a number of steps in recent years to improve budgeting accountability and transparency in a variety of agencies, including going back over a decade, the legislature directed school districts to provide uniform accounting standards so that the public could easily determine how they were spending and how they're spending compared to other similar districts. Currently, no such standard exists for community colleges, and SB 519 would remedy that. So SB 519 would create a central clearinghouse where all community college budgets could be found online, and direct community colleges to use the same standards so that people could determining whether their spending has changed over time, how they're spending, proportions that they're spending on administration and so forth, and how they can compare to similar districts across the state. We very much appreciate the work in the policy committee and the cooperation from the HEC and Oregon Community College Association in working through a couple of amendments that we think improve the bill, and we urge your support today.
Okay. Questions for Jared? Thank you very much. We
thank
appreciate
you.
Your testimony. Is there anybody else here that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 519? If not, we'll close the public hearing on 519. Got somebody? Come on up. Give us your name and your testimony.
My name is
your testimony.
Brad Subramaniam.
Okay.
And I'm speaking on providing free tuition for community college.
That's the next one.
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
I thought that's 81.
Sorry, I confused myself.
Okay, that's all right. Representative Smith Warner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just so no testimony from the Community College Association on this?
Is there anybody here from the Community College Association that would like to testify on 519? Here she comes.
Andrea Henderson, Executive Director, OCCA. We worked with OEA on the amendments for this bill, and we're fine with the amendments as stand. So thank you very much.
They're laughing. Okay. Senator Roebling.
I want to comment. There was a lot of work done on this bill in the Education Committee, and the community colleges worked very hard with HEC, with OEA and the others about how to craft this, and the person who brought it to us was Senator Dembro, all to make sure that it would work in a way that everybody could agree to. So I appreciate all the work that was done.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing. I think I already did that, didn't I? 519, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 81, which is what we have the longest list of people here to talk to us about. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 81 comes to you from the Senate Education Committee, and it is a bill that would waive tuition for certain courses at community colleges under certain conditions that are subject to the students or the that would be applying for that waiver. They must have been a resident for at least 12 months, have not had tuition paid for more than 4 years, has applied and accepted all state and federal grants available to that person, has maintained a 2.5 or better grade point average for the term, for each term that is waived, and have not earned more than 90 credit hours, which effectively shortens it to basically a 2 year period for a average or a two the equivalent of two years of classes roughly. There is a sizable fiscal in the bill's current form. We're still working on the fiscal, but that fiscal will be based in part on an NCHEMS report, which is underneath your OLIS under Ben Cannon's HEC testimony. So that would be the basis, and that provides a fiscal in the neighborhood, and we're still working on it, of $30 million in the bill's current form. And I believe Senator Hass and Representative Johnson and, I guess, Representative Reed are here
yes.
to present the bill.
Okay. Come on. And who wants to go first? Senator Hass.
Thank you, Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Comp and Committee. Mark Hass, Senate District 14. Good to be back before this committee again. It seems like a rite of passage as we start winding down each of these sessions. I have some prepared written testimony that I'm passing out there, and I won't read it into the record, even though I know how much you love that when people do that. I just want to say we started working on this a couple of years ago, yeah. asked HEC to do a study about the same time that Tennessee and some other states were looking at this. And I wish we could have been first, that Oregon could have been the first state to do this, but Tennessee was first, and they started last year. But there's great value in Tennessee going first, because we can see what happened in Tennessee. And what we have seen is it worked really well, because they're using the same model that this bill proposes, which is last dollar in. And we had a hearing in the Senate Education Committee, but more recently in Representative Reed's committee, where we Skyped in some Tennessee officials, and they told us some things about how they've skyrocketed as number one in the country in terms of FAFSA applications, federal aid applications, by far the highest state in the country, from students under this program who are getting Pell Grants. And Pell Grants have doubled in size under the Obama administration. So there was a lot more available money than there used to be. And they were receiving upwards of $200 million in Pell Grants into Tennessee. They have a slightly larger population than us. And their first year expenses for their state was $14 million. Ours are estimated to be around $20 million. I think we'll get closer to that once we have these amendments finalized. But that feels like a pretty good value. And what was remarkable to me was in Tennessee, 55% of the students who applied for Pell Grants got full Pell Grant funding, full Pell Grant funding. So there are thousands of kids in Tennessee community colleges today learning to be welders, machinists, dental assistants, police officers, who are getting that training and education under the free community college program in Tennessee, and it's not costing Tennessee a dime. And it just took this program to push those kids there. And I think we would have the same dynamic here. So I just want to give you some of the financial aspects of why we're so optimistic about this. And I think it goes without saying that the reason this is a good idea isn't just the finances, but we have a growing population of young people in Oregon, about 70,000 of them, according to the Oregon Youth Commission, between 18 and 24, who are categorized as idle youth. Young people that have nothing going on. They have a high school education, but they don't have any opportunity for a secondary, post-secondary education. They're not bad people. They're not criminals. But until they get an opportunity, they are likely to be going down a pathway toward poverty. And I think what this bill does is shows them an opportunity to find a pathway to the middle class. So that's the goal here. Appreciate your consideration and working with us on this bill. We've been here in similar higher ed bills in 2013 and 2011. Same chairman, some of the same faces. And if you remember, when we did those higher education restructuring bills, there was angst and resistance from the higher education community. We're not sure about this. We don't know if it'll work. And you'll have that same angst and resistance from the people who will follow us up here, not wanting to change the status quo. But those bills did pass, and right now those very same people who are resistant are grateful. The sky didn't fall in. And so our mantra, the three of us always, you know, use that old saying that you can marshal an army to protect the status quo. I urge you to look at the benefits for these young people, for our employers, and not cave to the status quo.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, co-chairs. For the record, Mark Johnson, House District 52, and I want to thank my good colleague here, Senator Hass, for allowing me to get involved with his initiative. He's obviously put in a lot of time on this. I came in a little bit late, but sometimes it helps to have more cooks in the kitchen as you try to craft a tasty dish, and I think that's what we're able to accomplish here. But I really, the overall arching, I think, theme here is that I think what we're trying to do is change the culture in Oregon to one to where some degree of post-secondary credentialing and or credits become the norm for everybody. Everybody should have an opportunity to do that, because as we've all known, and we totally understand, our economy requires it now. You know, as Senator Hass likes to say, the days are gone when you can walk out the door with, you know, your high school with a diploma in one hand and go work in that lumber mill and you've got a great, you know, family wage job for life. It doesn't happen that way anymore. So that's really what it's about. My contributions, I think, have been trying to provide some more context to the wraparound services and uh, the the human touch that I think so many of our students need in order to be successful. And I hope you have a chance to have access to the Dash 5 amendments to the bill. I think they're up on OLIS. I'm sure they're there if you can look at those. But what we have, and my idea here is that in trying to build on some of the frameworks and support services that we already have within the state of Oregon, we can provide the kind of wraparound and support services that students are needing. And you know, you're all familiar, I'm sure, with the Aspire programs that we have in our high schools, not in every high school, but in the vast majority of them. Aspire is also in the process of being rolled out in a good way within our colleges as well, provide that sort of mentoring, guidance, help students access financial aid, make course decisions, that kind of thing. Tennessee requires every student that's going to access their free community college to have at least two meetings with a mentor before they even fill out their FAFSA. That's the kind of one-on-one operations that relationships that we're envisioning here, and I think Aspire is a place to go to provide that. It's already an existing framework, an existing structure we have in Oregon. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We may have to embellish that, obviously. But the point is we have those metrics in place that can provide that sort of access. So we're going to require mentorships with Aspire volunteers. We're also going to require some sort of community service as well, and or a $50 copay. There needs to be some sort of skin in the game. So we will leave that optional for the student to make that determination based on what's best for them. We've had some tremendous feedback from the business community and I would say from our Regional Achievement Collaborative supporters or friends as well, who believe that this initiative can open up opportunities for connections with business and industry that currently don't exist, because we're not just talking about associate's degree here, we're talking about career certificates as well. And I think when we get into this, or this is rolled out, I think it's going to create a dynamic where industry and business in specific regions of the state can go to their colleges and say, you know, this is the kind of career certificate that we really need for our industry. Can you put together a program, whether it's computer programming, whether it's software design, whatever it may be. It could be, you know, fermentation science, depending on the region and so forth. But it's that kind of option as well. But rather than simply have state dollars pay for all of that expense, we now can leverage federal money to pay for some of this as well. And that's what I think is exciting about it. But I would say, though, that this initiative, Senate Bill 81, and the free and reduced tuition for students can only happen if it also happens in conjunction with the conversation about the fifth-year programs that currently are being used and being implemented in certain districts across the state of Oregon, where they intentionally encourage their seniors to not graduate so that they can stay around for another year and access community college, which is okay, and have access to mentors and connectivity with humans to help them navigate life and so forth. But they're doing that completely on state school fund dollars.
Yep.
And it's getting to be expensive. Yep. I think at the last count, I think in the last biennium, we're at about $18 or $19 million now. That will only go up. I can tell you I have firsthand, knowledge that Portland Public is actively considering doing this soon. I can tell you from Hood River County School District, our superintendent has a plan he would love to implement next year. We're going to try to start doing that as well, because you can't. Okay, it's in the student's best interest. There's no question about that, but it's going to break the bank on the state school fund if we don't do something. So that conversation needs to happen. And there is another bill you have in this committee where we're hoping to get language into the bill that would take advantage, that would make that come to pass. But let me just say too, some of you I think might have seen the Secretary of State's audit of our community college that came out yesterday. I just grabbed a few little sound bites that I thought might be helpful for our discussion today. Community colleges have introduced sound practices to improve student success, but they can reach less than one quarter of the students in need. Coordination, support, and analytic capacity are needed to improve student success and to access proposed changes as outcomes-based funding. With open access policies, relatively affordable tuition, accessible locations, variety of program, community colleges attract diverse students, including those who may need extra academic support or have fewer financial resources. It goes on and on, but the point being, our community colleges are doing a great job, but I really think that they can have their mission improved by making a statewide initiative to allow every student who has a desire to access college at an affordable price, Obviously, this is only tuition. Life goes on. You'll hear from some folks behind us, I'm sure, that they would love additional support as well. But this is only about tuition. And I think it's a great step in the right direction. So I'll let Representative Reed. Yeah, his comments as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. Representative Johnson and I serve on the Higher Education Innovation and Workforce Development Committee together, and I think this is a bill that brings all of those things together very nicely. We didn't have the bill itself, obviously, in our own committee, but we did have a hearing on the topic, and we both participated in the hearing on the Senate policy side. So I hope, just to echo a few themes that my colleagues have said here, I think they did a good job of laying out the bill and its details. And I just want to echo a couple of things they said as themes that I hope you'll keep in mind during the rest of your conversation. One is just the broad support that we've had for this concept in the hearings that we held in the Senate and the House. We heard from one of our former colleagues, former Representative Galizio, having just left Clatsop Community College as president, and the PCC president were both there in enthusiastic support, and a variety of other stakeholders, some of whom have already been mentioned. We, I think, have set an ambitious goal with our 40-40-20 descriptions, and this community college component represents, I think, both some of the biggest challenge and the biggest opportunity, and it's our intent to be aimed pretty specifically at that. You've already heard the very important point about the avoided cost as people have these opportunities. When we make those kinds of investments, it's a cost that we don't have to spend on people who need services that result from their lack of opportunities. Similarly, we were, I think, all very taken by the description of the experience in Tennessee, the chance to bring federal money into Oregon almost without regard for what it does is a good thing. But in this case, it does really good things. So a chance to do that, to bring federal money in and invest in our own future and invest in the future of young Oregonians, I think is fantastic. And finally, the last thing I really want to mention is the message that this sends. Mm-hmm. Senator Haas frequently uses a great phrase about what impact this has on our mojo. If we're able to say to Oregonians that you have access to this opportunity, to community college, I think it changes the world and what's available and what people think about as they're going through the education system wherever they are in Oregon to think about that possibility that they might not have considered before. This is one of those things that it's easy to point at details, it's easy to find reasons not to do it, but it's one of those things that we can do. We have the ability to do it. The question is whether we will choose to exercise it. And I think years from now, if we're able to do this, all of us will be able to look back on our service in the legislature and point to this as one of the very best things we ever did. So you'll hear lots of details and lots of other conversation today, but I hope you'll think about those themes, and I hope we'll be able to pass the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure mojo is defined in statute, but we could go there. It might not be a bad thing. Couple of questions, Senator Haas. First is, you and I were on the Accelerated Learning Task Force, and so I'm wondering how you envision this in relationship to that as far as driving down into the juniors and seniors in high school. And then number two is, has Tennessee been going long enough that we have any information as far as impact on their universities?
thank you, Representative Huffman. First, there's been no when we Skyped in the Tennessee director, and he said there hasn't been an impact on universities so far, but maybe it's too early to tell. But so far, there has been. They see an impact on kids are making sure they graduate because they can't participate, so they think mm-hmm. this will bump their high school graduation rates, which wouldn't be a terrible thing for Oregon. As far as the other concept of increasing the number of kids who can earn dual credits in high school, I think these two are separate but joined at the hip. this community college idea won't solve all of the problems of the world. It won't eradicate poverty. It won't solve world hunger. It's just one good step to take, and there's a dozen other things we have to do for our education in this state. But I think they kind of do a one step and a two step. It just You know, we need the state to do a better job of getting access to dual credits and college credits while kids are in high school. Mm-hmm. And then we need to make sure this group of young people, this growing, burgeoning population, has at least access to a community college program.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
5-plus-year high schools has been a concern of mine, and we had had a hearing, I think we were discussing that probably about a month ago, and Mr. Saxton was in, and he seemed to have surprisingly little information on the financial impact. You seem to have been able to come up with a $19-ish million, I assume that's biennial impact.
Right.
Have you been able to study it more or get more information? Because for me, the thought of Beaverton or Salem-Keizer or Portland moving to an expanded, and Rob even told us that there were examples of 7- and 8-year high school programs in Oregon, and I hadn't heard that one.
Well, Representative Huffman, the Department of Education has done a study on this. Mm-hmm. It was the cost to the K-12 fund was $19 million in this biennium that we're in now. 26 school districts mm-hmm. are doing it. And again, we all agree their hearts are in the right place.
Exactly.
But there's a couple flaws. One, they're taking money out of the K-12 fund. And two, they're not accessing federal money. It's 100% state paid. So, you know, I don't need to tell anybody here about federal money and the beauty of leveraging federal money. You all get that pretty well. So those are the two flaws. I wish some of those programs could stay, but we need to do a better way of doing exactly what those high schools are doing in a more effective way that leverages that federal money.
Well, and I'll say, our co-chairs and Rep. Huffman, what you'll see in the amendments, it'll be in Senate Bill 418. We'll talk about trying to glean from those fifth-year programs those components that they believe are most beneficial for students, i.e. in student contact, mentorship, support services, and how can we import those into a statewide system that could be available for everybody, not just in those select districts. So that's in view of what we're trying to propose on a parallel track to go along with this as well. So, because obviously there are real benefits to that. You know, some students just need more time, and they can benefit from having more one-on-one contact with mentors or counselors or whatever. So can we then import some of those wraparound services to access, to have students be able to access, whether you're in Corvallis or Burns or Baker or, you know, Pendleton as well? So that's the question.
Okay. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. Senator Hass, you mentioned Tennessee did this program. They have a larger population than we do. Their fiscal came in at about $14 million. Do you see the $20 million fiscal attached to this as being a little higher, or is there something in this program that's different than Tennessee and is going to cost more?
I think it's about in line. Their $14 million was for 1 year. Mm-hmm. Our $20 million or so is for 2 years. Their population is about 7 million. Ours is about 4 million. So,
okay. So that's pretty close.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for doing this. I've spoken, I think, individually with all of you at varying levels about this, and I've said. You know, privately and publicly, that I would love. I mean, I think in the 21st century, expanding free education to K-14 makes a ton of sense. And at the same time, I get people are afraid of change, and that is an issue we have here all the time. And we also want to just make sure that we're doing it that we're focusing on where there is the greatest need. Mm-hmm. So my big questions, I think, would be, number one, a lot of people right now can qualify and pay for community college on grants in the Oregon, on Pell Grants and the Oregon Opportunity Grant because of their income level. And I guess my question number one is, who is this going to be mostly impacting? Because I'm mostly concerned about low-income kids, including first generation, all of that, being able to access that. And I think that a lot of that exists already. And so I just want to make sure that we're not taking away, if this ends up being a general fund thing, that we're not taking away from greater opportunities for them. Because it's not just the cost. We talk about this in here all the time, but it's not just the tuition costs. It's the everything else. It's the kind of living and whatever that you can use, that you might be able to use Opportunity Grant for stuff, but this is still not going to help you with that. So if you're a middle-income kid who's now going to be able to do this, but you're still, you know, but... Sorry, I'm wandering a little too far off there, and I'm really trying to make this into a question, I swear. So the question is, you know, who is this going to, what are the income levels that this is going to impact? That's my concern, is this just us helping kind of middle-class kids who have other opportunities for this? And then I have another question about Tennessee things, but I want to let you answer that, if I may.
Yeah. Gentlemen, thank you very much. We've got a lot of people that want to testify. Representative Taylor, briefly.
I actually have a few questions. I'm sorry. They're more academic in nature. And this is important. I really do commend you for having an innovative new idea and trying to get, you know, have access for students to, you know, have access to education. I love audits. So, of course, when it came out yesterday, I had to read the audit. And there's a couple things. One is that we already we have some problems with staffing reductions already at the community colleges. I just wanted someone to talk a little bit about that. And I think Senator Hass, that I hear you about the federal offset, you know, and I think maybe part of what's going on is that perhaps you could just explain in more detail so everyone in the room, people are hearing, understand, maybe talk about what the marginal difference would be of what the gain would be by having more students, you know, receive the federal dollars. Because when you just do the simple math, which is, I think, is what a lot of people are doing, it seems like, we're going to have less money. So if you could explain how the federal offset would be beneficial to the higher education system and to the individual community colleges, that maybe would clarify things for folks. And then lastly, somebody, I don't know, an hour later can talk about, it's on page 6 of the audit, and they talk about the challenges to completion, and the challenges to completion are, there's 4 things. The first one is money. The second is academic support and development courses. The third is child care, and the fourth is transportation. So these are the things, and other folks, as you know, come before and talk about why kids aren't finishing school. So I just kind of wanted to understand how, and maybe you probably have answers to all that. I'm sure you
do. Well, we do, but the two of you just signed up for an hour and 45-minute.
Okay, well, maybe someone can get back to me later about all of that then.
Testimony we had from Tennessee was it brought in about $200 million in federal money. That's a lot of money. I mean, if you think about the rural security money on timber, counties that we're getting from the federal government, that's $100 million, and that's a big deal. Every year we get that or not get that. This will be in that magnitude that will go in effectively into families and then to community colleges.
Okay.
And a lot of it will go to poor people who wouldn't sign up, poor families, poor students, without a program like this. That's just the dynamic. That's just how it works. That's what happened in Tennessee. And a lot of it will go to middle-class kids. And I make no apologies for helping middle-class families.
Exactly.
We've got $1.2 trillion in debt, college debt in this country, and middle-class families often find themselves in the point where they're not poor enough to qualify for the low-income programs, not wealthy enough to go to the expensive universities. And so if this is an opportunity for them to, without incurring debt, get an 8-month certificate in welding, I think it's a job well done.
I would just add, I think, and this gets back to, I think, what Representative Smith Warner was asking about, too, in terms of how is this going to change when we do have folks, kids who can access aid now, which can essentially pay for their tuition, but what they don't necessarily have access to is a person to help them navigate the system, some personal connection, some relationship with somebody who can make sure they fill out that FAFSA on time, help them with course selection, make sure that these courses are aligned with a degree or a certificate and so forth. And that's what's in view here that I think just doesn't necessarily exist everywhere right now. It can in some of the districts where they're doing fifth-year programs, but as we've talked about, those are just not financially sustainable. So the view would be here to take what's good and what really is helpful for those students in those programs, roll it out statewide, and as well as lowering that hit we're going to have on our general fund in a very short order if we don't do something about that. So That's I would just throw that out there.
One last point on that, Mr. Chair. The experience in Tennessee, we saw huge gains in the number of people who filled out the FAFSA. So lots of people who were eligible but weren't doing it, but for this marketing message essentially saying this is possible for you, so you should do it. And there, the percentage of people who were part of that were in sort of the upper income ranges was quite small in Tennessee.
If I could add, we had testimony from the Oregon Youth Commission. The thing about these people in this category is they're not cheap right now. They're on social services, and the Youth Commission says they're about $14,000 a year in social services and direct costs to society. Mm-hmm. And the day that one of them takes a job at Gunderson Marine as a welder is the day that $14,000 a year meter stops.
Senator Just Thompson. Real quick, I think what I hearing Rep. Johnson say is with the program, the fifth year program is starting to hit our K-12 budget. Mm-hmm. It's up in the 18-20 million right now. Mm-hmm. And this program, if we do it, will cost it around 20 million, but it has some of those
same components.
Components in it that will do the same thing that program's doing, so we're shifting that money, covering that, and we're bringing in 100 200 million in federal dollars. Sounds like a winner.
And we're going to have to move on. We have a long list of people that want to talk to us. Thank you, gentlemen,
thank you
very much. We're not going to be voting on this today. We haven't been given the okay yet. Would like to ask people that I call forward to limit your remarks to no more than 3 minutes. I know the reps and senators took a lot more time than that, but that's because they have a title. So please limit your remarks to no more than 3 minutes. And let's start with Jeff Dents and Joel Fisher. And I don't see Joel. He was here. He runs around. Mr. Dents, go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Dents, President of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate. We represent the faculty of Oregon's public universities. IFS appreciates the hard work of Senator Haas in highlighting the access and affordability linchpins of the state's ambitious 40-40-20 goal. IFS shares the senator's concerns about student debt. The ability of our students to obtain a cost-effective college degree is one of the keys to the future of the state of Oregon. However, there are several problematic issues with Senate Bill 81 that inhibit its potential impact on students. First, Senate Bill 81 does not address the significant increase in the cost of student fees at Oregon's community colleges. While there are currently safeguards in place to protect increases in tuition, there is no corresponding procedure in place to limit student fee increases. A research project recently completed by students in my Applied Policy Analysis course revealed that student fees at community colleges have been raised an average of $9 per credit hour at Oregon's community colleges for the 2000-2015 period, which equates to nearly $400 a year. Despite the good intentions behind Senate Bill 81, students receiving the benefits of a community college tuition waiver under the bill may confront an increase in the net price of their education as community colleges raise student fees to mitigate the effects of static or lower tuition revenue. Second, the language in Senate Bill 81, which requires students to have accepted all state and federal grants available to the person, may adversely impact students' ability to complete their baccalaureate degree in a timely fashion. Given the maximum amount an individual can receive in federal Pell grants, this stipulation may leave students without sufficient financial aid to complete their undergraduate degree. Exhausting financial support before degree completion can trigger a violent cycle of debt which adversely impacts student lives. Finally, there has been discussion the funding to implement Senate Bill 81 will come at the cost of diminished funding for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. As noted by the state treasurer, opportunity grants are available to only 1 in 5 students that are eligible and apply. Given the underfunding of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, reducing the proposed amount of monies dedicated to the Oregon Opportunity Grant to pay for implementation of Senate Bill 81 will impair the ability of our most needy students to be productive citizens in an increasingly competitive global economy. IFS firmly believes in the precepts of access and affordability for higher education. However, Senate Bill 81 may leave the state holding a significant and underfunded fiscal obligation, which has the potential to negatively affect adequate funding levels for higher education, especially the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The unintended consequences linked to Senate Bill 81, especially unchecked student fee increases, exhausting Pell Grant eligibility before degree completion, and adverse effect on Oregon Opportunity Grant funding require your thoughtful deliberation on whether Senate Bill 81 serves the best interest of our most valuable resource, our students. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fisher?
Chair Monroe, Chair Comp, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of the Oregon Business Association. We are here in support of this bill, in support of lots of the ideas that have been bubbling up all session long around accelerated learning, dual credit, and other ideas that are aimed at addressing this pivotal time in students' lives where we are trying to get students to help our state get to our goal of 40-40-20, and not just meeting that goal, but putting our state on a path towards economic prosperity, giving people an opportunity to get better jobs, to better themselves. This is one of those good ideas. Financing of a college career is expensive. It's one of those big barriers to a student's education. It stops a lot of students. We appreciate the kind of the branding that can come around this, the message that we're sending to students that that it will be paid for, that they can go to college. Whether it's free community college, accelerated learning, dual credit, we urge you to do something that accomplishes this goal. We have a couple different ideas that would really that would get us there, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's hear from Greg Hammond and John Wyckoff.
Co-chairs Monroe and Comp, for the record, I'm John Wyckoff, and with me today for Oregon Community College, and with me today is Greg Hammond, president of Lynn Benton Community College, and we'll go ahead and start with Greg.
Oh, thank you. Yes, for the record, it's Greg Hammond, president of Lynn Benton. I'm also on the Oregon Quality Education Commission, and I am speaking on behalf of the 17 community colleges of Oregon who are wholly committed to the concept of access and really are grateful for the attention that Senator Haas and Representatives Johnson and Reed bring to this issue. We have a long history of that commitment to access. But we also recognize that moving forward towards 40-40-20, which is a completion agenda, requires a broad and comprehensive strategy for making student success possible. And I'd like to talk with you about a few ways in which we have thoughts on Senate Bill 81. First, tuition covers less than half of the cost of providing an education for a student. And so every time you add a student at the front of our door, which is a great thing, okay, we're faced with where do I get the rest of the money to actually serve that student so that they will not just be in our door, but they will succeed once they are with us. The Tennessee model has a whole lot of things for us to learn. But one of the things it has for us to learn is they fund education in the top 20 of states in this country. We fund education at the 46th state. Our capacity to support that student who comes to our front door is critical if we are to achieve the goals that we have set for ourselves. and I do believe that it would be a setback for us to create a demand, which we certainly want, but not at the same time create the capacity to serve those students. And that is a grave concern to us. The second concern that we have has to do with bill's capacity to support low-income students, those who are most fiscally disadvantaged in terms of their access to education. Currently, the Pell Grant exceeds the cost of tuition, and therefore, for those who fill a FAFSA out and complete that and receive a Pell Grant, their tuition is covered. So Senate bill has no fiscal benefit to them. it will have a greater fiscal benefit to a student who comes to us, applies, but is not eligible for a Pell Grant, and therefore a free tuition option does benefit them. But we have a concern about that low-income students. Our low-income student, Pell-eligible, Pell-receiving students still take out an average at my institution of over $3,000 per year in loans. They have an unmet need, which will not be addressed by Senate Bill 81. And that is a concern for us. We want to make sure that if we're going to create access, we do it in a way that actually focuses on those who have the greatest need for that help. Third, again, we're concerned about student completion. We want to make sure that once the student is in our door, that we do provide the kinds of wraparound services that Representative Johnson was mentioning, that we're very proud of, that we are able to provide in accelerated learning programs and that require personnel, that require the kind of attention to a student that guides them not just in our door but out our door with that degree.
And we're going to need to move along.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. We appreciate your input. And the good things you're doing down there at Lynn Benton.
Thank you.
We're aware of the success that you've had and continue to have.
And of all of our schools.
Yeah, John? So.
Yeah, if I could, I just make a couple of quick points again for the record. John Wyckoff, Oregon Community College Association. And I want to just go back to sort of talking about a little bit about the cost that we've talked about being sort of that roughly $20 million. That number was based off looking at current enrollment trends. And sort of the graduating high school class. And I mean, one of the things Tennessee saw was when they changed the price to free or advertised the price as free, they expected about 25,000 FAFSA applications and got 75,000. Now, they haven't had that cohort starts in the fall, so we don't really know what that enrollment will look like. But the point is, 20 million, if that trend holds, is probably far too low. And then it doesn't provide any of the support, as you heard from President Heyman, for those students. And the concern is for for all of our students who have, a lot of them have very high needs and need wraparound services. If we don't get corresponding money from the legislature to fund capacity, we will be cutting into those services, as we did during the recession when our enrollment went up significantly and our state per student funding came down significantly. That's what that would look like if you don't fund capacity. So we would actually be having to cut the services to our lower income students. And we asked a lot of our colleges to look at what is the debt that students, we asked them to look at students under age 20, kind of looking in the frame of who would be likely in this bill, who get the Pell Grant and who do not, and what are their loan amounts. And we found, and these are rough numbers, we're still going through them, but that the difference was really only about $1,000. Students who did not receive the Pell Grant were taking out about $4,500 in loans, roughly, and then students who received it were about $3,500. And so the difference there is really only $1,000, but you would be providing about a $4,000 benefit and more for those sort of middle-income students. And we understand that middle-income students, I mean, they are, at all levels of in higher education, just like low-income students, their debt is getting higher and higher. But I think for those low-income students, they're not going to feel like this is free community college, because they're going to be paying with most of their Pell Grant will be gone, and the Oregon Opportunity Grant, a lot of eligible students simply don't receive it. So that money they're supposed to spend on living expenses will not go very far. And especially if we don't actually get the amount of money this would cost, we would have to raise tuition on the folks for whom we can still raise tuition if this isn't funded appropriately. One quick point.
Okay. I'll make my last. Have is to cut
we off. Also have the PERS decision, where we know our costs are going to go up, and that's something we have to factor in. And so we're just concerned about what this could do to cost if the cost issues aren't really addressed, and the fact that it at this point it doesn't address low-income student concerns, and if it's not funded appropriately, and taking capacity into consideration, could actually disadvantage low-income students. And with that, I will close, because I'm getting a dirty look.
Thank you very much. Next panel will be Debbie
Koreski.
Okay, and Jock Mills and Haas Bernard.
It'd be great to get a couple of new students up here.
Good morning, members of the committee, co-chairs Monroe, co-chairs Comp. Given your time and given the points that were just made in the previous testimony, there's not much that we can add. I think the question was asked earlier about trying to to demonstrate who is it who's actually going to benefit from this program compared to where you've over the last 3 weeks had a great display of need is the issue that brings us to the table as well in terms of where is the money really going to go, which Oregonians are going to benefit when you have such a high degree of need. The one other issue that I want to bring up is the our experience with the tuition buy-down during this current biennium. That was a $40 million cost that was supposed to be for one biennium. But to maintain that, that actually turned into a $60 million cost. That was to reduce tuition by essentially 2 percentage points. This program is the potential for being no different in terms of potential cost increases, except for this is free tuition. This isn't just a 2% tuition reduction. And I'm happy to answer any questions. If you want to go into these in depth in the future, I'd be happy to do that as well.
Your name.
And I'm sorry, for the record, I'm Jock Mills, Director of Government Relations for Oregon State University. Thank you very much, Rep.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
Co-chairs Monroe and members of the committee, for the record, Hans Bernard with the University of Oregon. Building on Jock's comments earlier and what else you've heard this morning, I think the one thing that we would add, in addition to being concerned about sort of how dollars are targeted, would be the experience of Tennessee and where they sit in terms of funding for higher education across the board nationwide. Their system, from our perspective, was much more equipped to handle a significant influx of new students, and the funding was there to provided by the state for the institutions to accommodate those individuals. We worry that this would create different incentives for students. The dollars would not be targeted toward those most in need, and then the institutions would not be able to serve the students when they arrived. So those are, I think, our primary concerns at this point. We share the stated goals and the desire to provide access and opportunity for all Oregonians that the proponents of the bill have brought forward, but we just are uncertain as to whether or not this gets you there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Debbie?
Hi, for the record, my name is Debbie Kresge, and from Portland State University. And if the current trends hold for transfer students, Portland State University would probably absorb about half the transfer students from community colleges because of the nature of the relationship between Portland Community College and Portland State University. I mean, we currently get about half now, so you would probably expect that trend to continue. So just a little perspective into that relationship, because the bill now focuses. First of all, let me just say, from Portland State University, we totally beg you to change the status quo. The status quo has not been good for our university. So please do things differently, because we think that different might be better. We're still waiting to see the full effects of our new board. So far, so good. But status quo, we are not here to support the status quo. The status quo for us is next year, we will make we've raised our tuition 4.8%. We will make a $4 million cut. Just to let you know, $30 million extra for universities would fill that hole for us. On behalf of the non-PAC 12 schools, OIT will also be making cuts next year at the co-chair's recommended level. Eastern is in retrenchment, which means that they tell people you no longer have a job. They tell students your program's no longer offered here. Southern is also in retrenchment, and Western most likely will also be making cuts next year, depending on some legislative actions. So, you know, the universities are not hardy places at the moment. They are lean places, and we are still making cuts. So if we were to absorb these transfer students, we would not be able to absorb a massive new influx of transfer students. Transfer students have unique needs. You have to fill out their transfer evaluation reports, see what credits they have, make sure maybe they started out thinking they were going to be a business major. They did the transfer module for business, but then they discovered they love psychology. So now they've got to go back and pick up that foreign language at the university because they didn't take that. They thought they were going to be a bachelor of science major. They have very unique needs that require intensive advising, and I just don't think our university right now is robust enough to absorb them. So it's not that we wouldn't want them. It's just we would want to make sure that they would complete. transfer students also have a lot of sticker shock. And with all the talk of Tennessee, since that is my home state and I grew up there, just for comparison, at Southwest Tennessee Community College, which is a community college down the street from the house that I grew up in, the tuition per credit hour is $147 per credit hour. At Temecula this year, it's $96 per credit hour. The state appropriation in Tennessee is approximately double what it is here per FTE. Double. University of Memphis, their tuition is $1,000 a year higher than at Portland State University. It's a very comparable urban-serving university, lots of transfer students, a lot of non-traditional students, very similar universities. $1,000 more a year, their appropriation is more than double what Portland State gets. So these are not apples-to-apples comparisons. These are, at this point, apples to oranges. It's not that this isn't a good idea. It's a great idea, but we just need to make sure that we do it in a thoughtful way.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you, gentlemen. We're going to take one more witness, Mario Parker Milligan of the Student Association. Welcome. And Dana Richardson also signed up, but she's going to come back on Tuesday because she's around here all the time. So this will be it. Mario, good to see you again, and please give us your testimony.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mario Parker Milligan. I'm the Legislative Director with the Oregon Student Association. Thank you for your work and attention to increase accessibility to a quality post-secondary education for Oregonians. OSA represents over 120,000 students at Oregon's public universities and community colleges, and access is our number one issue every single session. Providing quality tuition-free post-secondary education to our students is something we once thought was a pipe dream. Now we know it could be possible. While the concept of free community college is appealing for students statewide, we are concerned that this policy, in particular, is not truly free. Our state is currently ranked 47th in the nation for funding per FTE, and student loan debt continues to rise to unsurmountable amounts for individuals and families. We're concerned that $20 million is not enough to get students in and to complete students, or for them to complete. Our institutions aren't lean. They are emaciated. This bill would not be of value for Oregon's low-income students and families, as it benefits those families who earn too much to receive the federal Pell Grant. This is highly important, as tuition is only about half of the total cost of attending college these days, meaning if you do qualify for Pell and apply that, and you have to apply that to the cost of your tuition, first, you will have to take out loans to cover the rest of your cost of living, which many students and families are doing now. We also believe that this cannot be another unfunded mandate for colleges. Before our state passes laws to create more access programs, we have to truly fund and restore funding to our institutions. The adverse impact on the post-secondary education system in Oregon could be enormous if this law passes and our institutions see a swell of enrollment without the infrastructure needed to support the increase. I cannot diminish the work that Senator Haas and Representative Johnson have put into making this a good piece of public policy. Their tenacity and fierce dedication to public higher education should be applauded. Students look forward to continuing to work with these champions and the HEC and other members on future proposals and encourage this committee to fund policies which help Oregon's most financially neediest of families to access a quality higher education. Oregon needs to restore funding to our institutions in order to stem the tide of tuition increases statewide and provide stability to our state's post-secondary education system. We look forward to continuing to work with folks and appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you. And one further witness.
Thank you. My name is Brad Subramaniam, and before I start, I'd like to thank Co-Chair Representative Klomp and Senator Monroe, Co-Chair as well. And I'm not against providing equal access to all for community colleges, but not when there are significant drawbacks. But before I start, there's one thing I want to clarify, and that's that community colleges are something that causes huge debt in students, especially lower-income students. However, this isn't entirely true. Community colleges cost in Oregon on average about $4,000 to $5,000. While it's the four-year large universities, like, for example, OSU, or from OSU to Harvard, which can cost from $25,000 to $65,000, that's what is causing the huge student debt. So this won't really be really fixing that. But then I'd like to talk about the Pell Grant section, which provides up to $5,700 per month in, per year in student grants. The cost of, as I said, the cost of community college in Oregon is around $4,000 to $5,000. So it really gives a lot of leeway for lower income students to pay for books, for example, which can cost up to $1,200. And so this is something that we should be looking to encourage students to get instead of providing free community college for everyone. I understand the system in Tennessee made up the difference between Pell Grants and the amount that the poor low-income students could not pay for. However, there's no really real need to do that because since the average is way lower than what Pell Grants provide, it gives plenty of leeway. The next thing I'd like to talk about is that community college dropout rates are very, very high. On average, there's 66 to 80% dropout rates. They're huge dropout rates. And so what this would be doing was it would be providing money to students who really have no intention of graduating. And of that 20 to 33% that do actually graduate, about 42% of them need to take some sort of remedial classes to graduate on time. And so a lot of these students are actually failing in community colleges, and this wouldn't be really fixing anything. Why should we be giving money to students who have no intention of graduating? We should be considering directing this money to other places, such as high schools, for example, to prepare these students for community college better, rather than simply giving it to them for free. Why should we give it to them for free if they're not ready for it? And my final point that I'd like to make is that the quality of education would decrease. So when passing this legislation, thousands of students would be attracted to the prospects of free community college. However, there's only 17 community colleges in all of Oregon. So what that would mean would be there would be hundreds, if perhaps even 1,000 students going into community colleges, and they would be overcrowded. The teacher-to-student ratio would go down, and the amount of resources available to the community colleges would go down as well. And so even if funding does increase, there's no way it can keep up with the amount of amount of students that are coming to community colleges. With Obama's plan, he planned to there would be an expected 9 million students, which is a huge amount. I understand Oregon would be much smaller, but let's look at our neighboring state, California, where they offered reduced tuition. And there's currently 472,000 students who are waitlisted, according to the California Chancellor's Office. So community colleges, especially in Oregon, are already overcrowded, and we can't simply add more students and expect them to keep up. It's simply not something that's viable. And so for the reason that poor students are already covered, it's not really necessary, that community college dropout rates are very high. So we shouldn't be really wasting money on people who have no intention of graduating, and that the quality of education would decrease. That's why I'm in negation of this legislation.
And we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank all of you for coming. Mr. Wilson, our next meeting will be on Tuesday.
And we will have Ms. Richardson here on this bill. And then hopefully, if we get approval, work session on TSPC and the fee bill that goes with it, 2411.
Okay. So we'll hear from Dana, and then we'll be working the TSPC budget and bill next Tuesday. We will not meet on Monday. Thank you all for coming, and we're adjourned.